Today at Reader's Corner, David Michaels, author of The Triumph of Doubt, Dark Money and the Science of Deception. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Not a day goes by without a report of a crisis involving opioids, concussions, climate change, exposure to dangerous chemicals, dangerous food additives, the list goes on. And industry too often tells us the science is unclear or wrong. But is it? In his latest book, The Triumph of Doubt, Dark Money and the Science of Deception, public health expert David Michaels traces the ascendance of science for hire in American life and government, from its origins in the tobacco industry in the 1950s to its current manifestations across government, public policy, and even professional sports. The Triumph of Doubt shines a light on the machinations and scope of manipulated science in American society. Dr. David Michaels is an epidemiologist and professor at the George Washington University School of Public Health. He served as President Obama's Assistant Secretary of Labor for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, known by its acronym OSHA. And he also served as President Clinton's Undersecretary for Environment, Safety, and Health in the U.S. Department of Energy. He has been hailed by the New York Times as a champion for worker safety. David Michaels, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Bob, thank you so much for inviting me on your show.
Well, why don't you, first of all, David, tell us about your work at OSHA. That was a long title I unloaded there, but it basically means you were running OSHA, as I understand it, back in those days. And what you call the astonishingly large team of experts it takes to produce an OSHA regulation.
That's right. I had the honor and the pleasure of running OSHA from 2009 to early 2017. I was actually the longest serving head of the administration of OSHA. No one else had made it 4 years, and I made it more than seven. I loved that job. Every day was exciting. It was different. And the staff at OSHA was just terrific. I mean, just dedicated people who care about workers and worker safety. The challenge of issuing standards is a huge one for many reasons. You know, standards are very powerful. They're laws. And so when the agency issues a standard, you've got to get it right. And it's very, it can be very time consuming. We issued a standard on silica, which can cause silicosis and lung cancer. OSHA started working on it in 1997, and I issued it in 2016. So that was a 19-year stretch. It shouldn't take that long, and there are lots of reasons it did. But OSHA has a small group of experts who write these regulations, and then OSHA takes comments, and we take, you know, hundreds or thousands of comments in many cases to make sure we get it right.
So give us an idea of those who want you to get it wrong. Maybe an odd way of putting it, but there are those out there who are trying to defeat the work of scientists that are showing the results of a certain product and what effect it may have on people. Give us an idea of who these science for sale specialists are and the product defense industry itself.
That's right. And that's what my book is about. What I saw, I had no idea about this before I was in the government. And I saw this first when I was at the Energy Department, when we issued a regulation on beryllium, which is a metal that causes a terrible disease called chronic beryllium disease. And it's used in every nuclear weapon. And the beryllium industry opposed the Energy Department issuing a standard even for our own facilities. So they hired one of these firms, which is a scientific consulting firm whose job it is to turn out reports and studies that the client needs. So they issued a report saying, it's just too complex. You know, we need more research to figure out what the right standard is, which is, you know, antithetical to public health. Public health, you make decisions on the basis of your best available evidence if you see that people are getting sick. And we had dozens of people getting sick. So what I saw when I left the Energy Department and went back to academia was that there are these companies whose job it is to provide whatever result their client wants. That's their business model. And, you know, if they produced a report that said their client's product was dangerous, they'd lose that client. They'd lose a lot of business. They wouldn't really exist. And so I'm always suspicious when I see a company that advertises, look, there's scare science out there. We have to make sure that your product is defended. Not that we have to get the answer right, but we have to essentially what they do is they will turn out a report, a study for the peer review literature, something that can go into a federal docket that they could testify in a court case when a sick worker is suing, claiming that they were made sick. Those experts, you know, they will very predictably say there's not enough evidence to show harm or we need to do more research. But whatever it is, it's always to protect the product and the corporation, not to protect the public and the environment.
You know, every book I read has an acknowledgments at the end where the author gets a chance to show the support he's received from his colleagues and family. You've added a disclosure section at the end of your book, which is quite unusual, but please share with us the point you're trying to make there.
Yeah, I think every publication should have a disclosure of potential conflicts of interest. You know, we now have that in scientific journals, that we expect that if you read an article in the New England Journal of Medicine or Science or Nature, you want to know who paid for the study. And that should be in books as well. In fact, one of the proposals I made in my book and actually implemented it when I was at OSHA is to say that if you're putting in comments to a federal agency, you should disclose also what are your conflicts of interest, because those are really important to understand who paid for your work, because we know that whoever pays for your work influences the way you think about your work. You know, and this, I have to tell you, it's a big issue in East Palestine, Ohio right now. The Norfolk Southern has hired a environmental consulting firm to measure exposures in the air. And the people in East Palestine, I think I'm pronouncing it right, they're very concerned because this is a company that regularly works for railroad companies and others that cause environmental disasters in this case. Can we trust their result? And what's interesting to me is I think there's really clear evidence that even if people are well-meaning, who pays your salary impacts your work. And, you know, Upton Sinclair said that years ago. He said, it's difficult to get a man to believe something when his salary is based on him not believing it. Mm-hmm. And so you really want to have people who are not conflicted, who are independent scientists doing this basic work around public health and the environment to make sure that we're getting answers that are not shaped by financial conflict.
Give us your take on a major player like Hill and Knowlton and these product defense firms that for years and years were successful at delaying action against tobacco products, for example.
Yeah, Hill and Knowlton, in some ways, you know, they wrote the book. In the story, which I teach my students in the School of Public Health, is, you know, we only really saw the clear relationship between tobacco and lung cancer in 1950. And that's because we didn't have widespread tobacco use in the United States until the 20s, because soldiers who came back from World War I were given free tobacco, essentially free cigarettes. They came back, they were smoking in the 20s and 30s. Of course, by the 40s, they started developing lung cancer. We had World War II, so there wasn't much research. But by 1950, it was overwhelmingly clear that cigarette smoking led to lung cancer, which was a disease that was almost unknown, you know, 50 years before that. So Hill and Knowlton, Hill and Knowlton, this PR firm, went to the tobacco industry and said, look, you have a problem. If people recognize that lung cancer can be caused by your product, you're going to have trouble selling your product. So you have to run a campaign to say, we're still doing research. We've got to figure this out. And in the meantime, you can keep smoking. And they did that very successfully. We learned about that in great detail eventually when there were lawsuits against the tobacco industry. And in one of the settlements, they agreed to essentially put up or send all of their documents to a library, the University of California, San Francisco, that digitized them all. And you can go back and look at how that strategy developed and how they used it. Out of that, though, came this whole product defense movement. You know, the tobacco industry said, let's produce doubt. In fact, there's a memo that says doubt is our product because it will establish controversy in the mind of readers and thinkers. So Hill and Hill and Knowlton, this PR company, then went on to do that same work over and over again for different corporations. When I was at the Energy Department, I received a memo that Hill and Knowlton had sent to the beryllium industry saying, look, you've got the public relations problem. We can help you. They didn't even mention their work for the tobacco industry, but they described how they worked, example, for DuPont. When DuPont was making chlorofluorocarbons that were causing, or that were predicted to cause, a hole in the ozone layer. And essentially what they said is DuPont was facing this problem. You know, this product they were making was alleged, the word they used, to be increasing the hole in the ozone layer. So we were able to raise controversy, essentially get 2 to 3 more years so DuPont could hold their market share until they figured out a different product they could replace it with. Mm-hmm. And of course, then we got 2 or 3 more years of the expanding hole in the ozone.
Right.
A lot of the scientists who worked for tobacco saw how lucrative this was. You know, going back to tobacco from it, for the first 20 years of this process, tobacco could always say, look, you can read the literature, you can figure out whether or not tobacco caused lung cancer. It's your choice. But when the studies started coming out showing that the non-smoking spouses of tobacco users were developing lung cancer, that was a whole different deal. It was no longer a personal health issue, but a public health issue. And so the tobacco industry had to take that on. They hired scientists to pull apart the studies, to demand the raw data so they could reanalyze the studies, essentially go after all the studies that showed that environmental tobacco smoke caused lung cancer. And that did delay things for a few years, so there's no question that, you know, those scientists were wrong. It does cause lung cancer. Anyway, those same scientists then went on to start other firms and to do the same work, pulling apart studies and raising controversy for pesticide manufacturers, for chromium manufacturers, you name it. And out of it came this product defense industry, which is very lucrative. There's lots of money to be made working for corporations, helping them defend their products.
You're listening to David Michaels. He's the author of The Triumph of Doubt, Dark Money, and The Science of Deception. You know, David, I thought of that old saying, perfect is the enemy of the good, as I was reading in your book about strategies that product defense firms use, one of them being demanding perfection from all research studies, and how it frustrates the work of the people who are trying to do something about this, including, I think, your own personal experience when you were attempting to declare diesel fuel a serious public health concern.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, being a government regulator, you have to look at what the evidence is, and you know, you've got to understand the overall picture, but you're going to recognize that you don't have the perfect studies, and you can't commission the perfect studies because we're talking about hazards. You know, the Food and Drug Administration says if you want to market a new medication, you've got to do a randomized clinical trial, and you have to use a placebo, and there's a gold standard on how to do that. You can't do that if you're trying to figure out if something like diesel exhaust causes lung cancer. You can't do the 30-year randomized study. You've got to use the best evidence you have. There's epidemiologic studies. There's toxicology. But you've got to make sure people are protected. You can't just say, let's wait until more studies come in. And that's exactly what happens. You know, the government will put together sort of a review of all these different studies and say, you know, it looks to us, we are very confident, and independent scientists who we've brought in are very confident that there is a risk from exposure to this chemical. It could double your risk of cancer or cause lung disease. Industry can always hire these scientists to say every single study in the government is using has some flaw. It could be a minor flaw or there's some issue. And you pull them all apart and they'll say, you have to do more research, you have to wait. We're seeing that now with these chemicals called PFAS, these fluorinated chemicals. They're in the news all the time. You know, they are used to make Teflon and Gore-Tex, and they're used in pizza boxes. They're really remarkable chemicals because they can essentially separate water and oil and, you know, wrap food very well without spoilage. The problem is they do cause all sorts of damage to your health at very low levels, and they never break down. They're called forever chemicals. If you look at the history of what we've learned about them over the last 20 years, we keep learning more and more. But you have the history of these product defense companies each time saying, no, that study is wrong, that study is wrong. And over the years, we get more and more studies. And you go back and say, obviously, these folks were wrong. At every point, they said, look, it's safe. There's no evidence it caused cancer. There's no evidence it causes immunological damage. But no one goes back and looks at these product defense scientists and say, you know, you were wrong so many times. Why do we even listen to you now? But sadly, that's what we're seeing.
Yeah, you mentioned the PFAS. I think in that particular case, DuPont actually did at some point get some serious fines, isn't that right?
Well, the interesting thing about PFAS, if you saw the movie Dark Waters, it goes through this. The early lawsuits led by a lawyer named Rob Billett took on DuPont, and DuPont agreed that they would pay for studies done by three independent scientists chosen by the attorneys on both sides of these court cases. And they did 7 years worth of remarkable studies. It cost DuPont a lot of money, but they found really significant health effects in communities where people, one community where people were drinking PFAS that was in their water. DuPont has then had to pay out quite a bit in legal costs and litigation because people who have those diseases have successfully sued DuPont because DuPont made them sick. So it's really, it's cost them, but you still have these product defense scientists who essentially say these studies that were paid for by DuPont and done by these world famous epidemiologists are not enough to say that these chemicals are dangerous. Mm-hmm. So we see it over and over again. It's predictable, unfortunately.
What's the Data Access Act and how does it compromise research science?
Well, the tobacco industry realized when this issue around environmental tobacco smoke came up that to go after an epidemiologic study, the best way to do it is to get the raw data. And you can do this sort of alchemy. I could do it if I want to change sides in this and go over the dark side. But if you have the raw data in a study, you could change around some of the parameters. You could say we're going to test things a different way, and you could turn a positive study into a negative study. And so the tobacco industry said, let's get some legislation that says if the federal government paid for a study, and the feds pay for most independent studies, that you have to make those raw data available. And they got other industries to front for them because, you know, this was in the 80s and 90s. If the tobacco industry was always already marked as being a pretty bad player. So they got other industries to say, we could use this raw data. And so now there's a federal law that says if the federal government paid for a study, if you had a grant from NIH, for example, then you have to give up your raw data. And I understand that. And it's very reasonable to want to do reanalysis. But what there now is this industry of people who will take the raw data from a positive study and turn it into a negative study. And all of a sudden, it's portrayed as you've got equal and opposite studies. They say the opposite of things. So therefore we can't move forward. And it's just one of the many tricks of the trade that I write about, how you can sort of do something to make something that is hazardous look less hazardous or not hazardous.
Yeah. You know, it's one thing that we have companies that are doing everything they can to slow down the research, to question the research. It's another thing when a company comes right out and lies and gets caught lying, and you give the grand prize in corporate wrongdoing to Volkswagen. As a matter of fact, just a little bit earlier, you mentioned diesel fuel and how it's so difficult to project studies using humans. Well, Volkswagen got around that and decided to use monkeys. Please tell us that story.
Well, it's an incredible story. This is separate from that Dieselgate story, which they got heavily fined for and paid out hundreds of millions of dollars in fines because they put in a software essentially said that they're when you test their engines, it doesn't look like they're really putting out much exhaust. But the other story that I write about is after studies that were done by U.S. Researchers, federal researchers, that showed that diesel exhaust increased risk of lung cancer. And these were studies done deep in underground mines where people weren't exposed to any carcinogens, but they were exposed to diesel exhaust. So they're really convincing studies. So Volkswagen said, well, what are we going to do? Because the World Health Organization was designated diesel exhaust as a lung carcinogen. So Volkswagen decided it needed to show its engines were safe. So first they were going to do a study where they put people in chambers on, exercising on a bicycle, where they'd pump in essentially diesel exhaust and show that didn't really impact their lungs. That, first of all, that wouldn't answer the question about cancer, but also the optics of a German company putting people into a chamber and pumping in gas didn't seem to be something that they really want to go with. Well, so they decided to do it with monkeys. So they found a laboratory in New Mexico where they put monkeys in these chambers into which engine exhaust was pumped. And the monkeys had to watch cartoons that would keep them calm And then they would essentially take the monkeys out and they'd examine their lungs. They'd look at what the impact of the lungs were of breathing this diesel exhaust. What Volkswagen did, and they didn't tell the researchers, was they brought in these Volkswagen Beetles that were, had the software that made sure that when they were, they did it in a way that the software ensured that the Volkswagen would essentially put out very little diesel exhaust. And they compared that to monkeys who were breathing exhaust from an old Ford F-250, which was really polluting. They essentially rigged the study to show that, you know, their new diesel powered cars wouldn't be dangerous to the, you know, to the monkeys' lungs. So the study was rigged, but they did the study so badly that they didn't find the result that VW wanted. So VW held back the payments until the researchers changed the results to give Volkswagen the results they wanted. That all happened just before the Dieselgate scandal broke. So the whole thing fell apart. But it just shows you the lengths that companies would go to defend a product that's clearly dangerous.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with David Michaels, author of The Triumph of Doubt. In the book, Michaels details how corrupt science becomes public policy through the aid of dark money and where it's happening today. There's that term we use in basketball of working the refs, where the coach is always berating the ref for calling the wrong call. You use it in reference to product defense. How so?
That's right. Well, let me give you an example. With companies that know what they're doing and influence federal agencies to make sure the agencies don't label their product as being dangerous. You know, the ref is the FDA or another agency. So Johnson & Johnson, for example, has this iconic product, Johnson's Baby Powder. And we've all used it. We know what it smells like. It's a reassuring smell. The problem is talc, which is, you know, a talcum powder product. Talc and asbestos are often together in the same mine. And it's very difficult to have talc that's asbestos free. In the 1970s, mineralogists working at Mount Sinai University, Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City, were experts on asbestos, were measuring some of these talcum powder products, and they found asbestos in it. And they told Johnson & Johnson, and they told the FDA. And the FDA was going to essentially say to Johnson & Johnson, you've got to really test much more. But Johnson & Johnson successfully essentially pushed the FDA into accepting a testing procedure that would never find the asbestos. You know, so they essentially were able to get out of ever having to really look for the asbestos so they could say, look, it's safe. Then in about 2000, in the George W. Bush administration, the National Toxicology Program of the United States, which I up until recently was on their board of scientific counselors, and the board of scientific counselors had looked at all the literature around talcum powder and said, you know, talcum powder should be classified as a carcinogen if it has this asbestos-like fibers in it. J&J and the firms that make talcum powder and talc products said this would be a disaster if, you know, baby powder had to be labeled saying it may contain asbestos. And so they hired the same consultants who worked for tobacco. And the memos are really remarkable. They said, you know, what we have to do here, and literally this is what the memo said, said, time to come up with more confusion. They've got to essentially confuse the scientists on the board of scientific counselors so they couldn't move forward with this labeling. To make a long story short, though, Johnson & Johnson is facing 40,000 cases, lawsuits by women who allege that their ovarian cancer was caused by exposure to baby powder or some other talcum powder product. And there are lots of studies that show that talcum powder is associated with ovarian cancer. There are studies that show it's not associated. But the fact that Johnson & Johnson really worked the refs to make sure that they never had to address the asbestos problem has put them in a really hard place. And you may be following this in courts. They actually tried this thing called the Texas two-step, where they essentially spun off a company with all that liability and said, okay, that company will deal with all the lawsuits. And a court just said they couldn't do that. But yeah. Johnson & Johnson has said that they're going to stop selling talcum powder-based products now in the United States, or actually the world. And they are doing something now they could have done 20 years ago, which essentially replaced talcum powder with cornstarch. People would think it was the same. It would feel the same. It would smell the same, and we wouldn't have any risk of disease. But they fought that.
You know, you say at one point that to get the science, the accurate science behind a particular product or problem, you've got to do it by lawsuit. And that has to do with the fact that there are statutes missing from the law that unfortunately still allow for the secret funding of front groups. They remain legal, I guess, in the U.S. Could you help us understand that?
Yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate. You know, the addressing public health concerns through litigation is not the best way to do it at all. It's, you know, it's after people have been made sick, and it's way after the fact. But until we have laws that essentially say we're going to protect people before they get sick on the basis of the best available evidence, you know, litigation tends to be the best way to essentially stop a dangerous product from being sold and learning about the history. You know, one thing that came up when I was at OSHA, there was a disease that got a lot of press some years ago called popcorn lung. Workers who make microwave popcorn were developing a disease called bronchiolitis obliterans. Their lungs were being destroyed. They had to get lung transplants. It turned out it was from breathing the chemical diacetyl, which was used to make artificial butter flavor. Clearly, workers need to be protected from that. When I got to OSHA, we were moving toward issuing a standard, but there were lawsuits against the manufacturers who turned out should have known that this was causing this terrible lung disease. And after $100 million worth of lawsuits, all the companies that made that product and their trade association said, we're going to stop making it. And so it was much more efficient than OSHA finally issuing a standard. You know, the litigation made a difference, and we don't see that disease anymore. There's no more popcorn lung because the lawsuit stopped those studies from occurring, those exposures from occurring.
In every one of these instances you're discussing here, there is an administrative process through which agencies evaluate scientific evidence. I think you allude in your book to some changes in that administrative process lately that makes it more difficult, not easier, to get to the bottom of whether or not a product is safe or not.
Yeah, no, there are all sorts of steps being taken to slow down administrative agencies. In fact, right now there's a hearing this week in Congress on something called the RAINS Act, which essentially would require that Congress approve every regulation an agency puts out, which of course would mean agencies would be paralyzed and we'd stop seeing, you know, protection against air pollution, for example. It's really problematic, but, you know, I think Americans recognize the need. They want safe drinking water. They want the air to be clean. They want their food to be unadulterated and not have chemicals that are going to make them sick. So I think there's going to be a struggle over this for many years. You know, it turns out the science around public health is really contested terrain. And I think we need more people to come out and say, look, these chemicals could be making us sick. There's evidence from toxicology or epidemiology. We've got to make sure the agencies protect us because individuals can't protect themselves. You know, you can't look at the side of a shampoo bottle and know which of these chemicals could be safe or which could be dangerous. You know, we need the government to make sure they could do that for us.
I have time for one more question, David, and I'd like to ask you to give our listeners a hint of how they might know whether experts are acting in a good faith. You cite some websites at the end of your book that at least give us some place to go to gauge whether or not we're getting the truth in a particular case or not.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things. One is, you know, I want to see, and I wish reporters would ask, when some scientist is quoted or some scientist testifies and they're working for one of these companies, Exponent or Gradient or Chemrisk, to look up those companies. If they've worked for a lot of different corporations, if they say they do litigation support, you know what they're doing. The other thing is I look up the employer of these companies and I look up the scientists in the what's called the Tobacco Truth Library at the University of California, San Francisco, which has all these documents. And if I find that these scientists were working for the tobacco industry, I know they have questionable ethics already. And so that's the first place I look.
Well, David, I'd like to thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. First of all, thanks for serving as OSHA head and the work you've done. I didn't have a chance to get into some of the very specific examples of your leadership in that agency, which you recount in your book, but there's also many examples in your book that we didn't get to. Again, this has been a valuable public service you've provided for the reader, and thank you today for joining us at Reader's Corner.
Bob, it's been my pleasure.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.